Resuming our sermon series on how ideas about the soul affect both individuals and society, a reminder that you can access audio recordings of prior installments on our UUCPA website if you like. As usual, I'll start with a condensed review of what's come before, though since it's been a while, today's recap is a little longer than most. I've described how, while the modern era has given humankind immense gifts, its dominant philosophy of materialism, which holds that physical matter constitutes the whole of reality, has also purged any transcendent or transrational, that is, beyond the rational, aspect from human life. And I've proposed that the resultant spiritual vacuum causes major personal and collective problems. And also, in agreement with mythologist Joseph Campbell, that archaic religious remedies, primarily meaning believe this or land in hell, Christianity and Islam, now mainly only aggravate these and related ills. Then, drawing on Plato, I offered a very different transrational template from those of traditional religions. The main points are that human beings have a soul and enter the world with a life blueprint and a personal calling and destiny. Plato also describes the soul's spirit companion, termed daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N in Greek, and genius in Latin, that guides the soul during its earthly excursion. And further, that when people identify and live out this calling as wholeheartedly as possible, it's personally beneficial and potentially culturally transformative. My latest installments then broadly described the historical emergence of materialism's soulless worldview, including the very understandable reasons this first became normalized, which was largely to break free of religious tyranny. I summed up that process by contrasting two views of the modern era, as articulated by cultural historian Richard Tarnas. The first is of an epic narrative of human progress, a long heroic journey from a primitive world of ignorance, suffering, and limitation to a brighter modern world of ever-increasing knowledge, freedom, and well-being. Yet, referencing the Titanic, an archetypal embodiment of modern achievement and affluence, I offered the contemporary French cultural critic and philosopher Paul Virilio's observation that when you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. Thus, the same cultural voyage that produced such enormous benefits has also wreaked unequaled devastation, including, as discussed previously, that of indigenous peoples by Western colonialist and religious powers under the Catholic Church's doctrine of discovery, which sanctioned the European, at the time mainly Spanish, seizure of the Americas. If you've ever wondered why so many places in California and other southwestern states are named San This or Santa That, both meaning saint in Spanish, there you go. This and other destructions then suggest a very different outlook on modernity's story, one that, again in Tarnas's words, reveals a progressive impoverishment of human life and the human spirit, a fragmentation of original unities, a ruinous destruction of the sacred community of being. And of course, both accounts, the wondrous ship and the horrendous shipwreck, are simultaneously true. A paradox I outlined last time up to the 1960s, which was when a critical mass of people judged the shipwreck side of modernism's worldview and practices intolerable. A shift in cultural consciousness that marked the latest historical course correction, now known as postmodernism. About that term, I said there's no single definition, and it's been applied in architecture, literary and cultural criticism, design, and other fields and schools of thought. Yet in general, its basic willingness to consider multiple perspectives tends to foster better understanding of other people's, and ecologically speaking, other beings' realities, and thus is often a starting point for empathy, which can then seek improvements. Thinker and author Steve McIntosh encapsulates this more attentive and inclusive outlook. The new we that coheres as the worldview of postmodernism is comprised of the victims of modernity, including individual people, races, and cultures, and the overall natural environment, together with those who are sensitive to the pain of victimization, even though they may not have been directly victimized themselves. This sensitivity is a collective parallel to something I spoke of when I discussed the doctrine of discovery. Author and former New York Times columnist David Brooks's transrational experience of recognizing the infinite value of all souls, in contrast to political and religious powers that often show themselves deaf and blind to others' value and to their suffering. We continue now with some findings from neuropsychology that help us understand why some people's senses are so blocked they can't perceive modernism's shipwreck side, as well as how this impairment constitutes a central underlying rift in our current cultural discord. As I go, a few bits may sound familiar, as I also mentioned pieces of this in October when I spoke on the nature of change and varied human responses to it. But that didn't include that in his book, Brain and Culture, Yale professor of psychiatry Bruce Wexler describes how the human brain is most malleable early in life. So when we're younger, our developing worldview admits a wide range of input and readily adjusts to new data and to diverse interpretations of these. But as adulthood sets in, our brains become less elastic, so gradually people unconsciously start trying to match their outer worlds to an increasingly inflexible inner one. One main reason that people attempt to maintain this match, one main way people attempt to maintain this match is to cluster with others who consistently validate their worldview, a strategy that contains both potent psychosomatic reinforcement mechanisms. For when inner beliefs and perceptions of the outer world match up, what Dr. Wexler terms consonance, it naturally feels good. But when that match is confronted by incompatible information, the resulting dissonance engenders mental ambiguity and thus apprehension, which in turn triggers some level of bodily stress response. Wexler further reports that such worldview clusters don't just passively affirm, but, quote, actively increase the conformity of members' beliefs, and that those who espouse positions contrary to those of the group are chastised, devalued, and threatened with exclusion, another common source of both mental and physical distress. Add another reinforcement, confirmation bias, in which people seize on data and arguments that support their beliefs and ignore, discredit, or simply forget conflicting evidence, and the cycle of desired certainty and acceptance frequently becomes self-perpetuating. All of this then limits exposure to and receptiveness of experiences and perspectives that don't already simply conform to one's worldview. And since large parts of these processes are unconscious, many people become convinced that their outlook isn't a product of their familial, cultural, and educational milieus, nor of the structures and aims of social, including religious, institutions, but rather that the world they perceive is the only real one, or at least the only right one, whether or not that conviction is anywhere close to justifiable. Like myself, Wexler sympathizes with how hard it can feel when our outer environments change so much that maintaining consonance is difficult, if not impossible. Citing as examples people who lose a loved one and adults who immigrate to an unfamiliar culture, he recognizes that adjusting to such disorienting shifts involves a, quote, effortful restructuring of the internal world to match the now changed external world. Of course, such personal changes have collective parallels. And in the 1960s, for the first time ever, that now changed world truly became not just personal or tribal or national, but global. Because on December 23rd, 1968, NASA astronaut Jim Lovell pointed a live TV camera from Apollo 8 and framed a grainy black and white shot of Earth from 175,000 miles away. The next day, as the spacecraft again rounded the moon, crewmate Bill Anders snapped perhaps the most perspective-enlarging photograph in history, an image of Earth ascending over the lunar horizon that came to be known as Earthrise. I think we're going to bring that up now. Yep. Just looking at it gets to me. It's amazing. The following day in the New York Times, poet Archibald MacLeish expressed the massive shift in awareness this image triggered. To see the Earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful, in that eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the Earth together, siblings on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold. Reprising Richard Tarnas's awareness from a prior talk that world views create worlds, this literal new world view that beheld the Earth and thus all humankind and all other creatures as it truly is, evoked like responses in countless hearts at the time. And mythologist Joseph Campbell spoke to the collective revisioning this calls for. As viewed by astronauts from the moon, the Earth lacks those lines of socio-political division that are so prominent on maps. And as recognized here below, the web of interlacing interdependencies that now enfolds the planet is of one life. All that is required is a general change of vision to accord with these contemporary facts. Echoing almost verbatim words Campbell also expressed elsewhere, world religious scholar Houston Smith draws the obvious conclusion in a one-line declaration of this interdependency. The community today can be no single tradition. It is the planet. It is the planet. And Smith recognizes the challenge of adjusting to this unprecedented circumstance. When historians look back on our 20th century, they may remember it most not for space travel or the release of nuclear energy, but as the time when the peoples of the world first came to take one another seriously. The change that this new situation requires of us all is staggering. Recalling Wexler, a measure of initial befuddlement and disquiet in accommodating this higher moon's eye view is certainly understandable. As the folk rock band The Birds sang in 1966, 8 miles high, and when you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known. Much less, or much more, 175,000 miles. And as both experience and allegorical legends the world over attest, even positive changes involve temporarily melancholy endings, as they require the symbolic death of more restricted worldviews and ways of being before a more expansive identity and its satisfactions can arise. Yet even with tough changes like bereavement or immigration, with some patience, effort, and support, people do adjust to altered situations all the time, often not only with tolerable but deeply gratifying results. But Campbell's general change of vision and the essential restructuring that stems from it can only start with admitting a shift has occurred. And in this regard, Houston, we have a problem. Because although the psychoneurological dynamics Professor Wexler describes hold true for everyone, sizable differences in both innate temperament and external surroundings, say being raised in an atmosphere of open exploration, hello UUism, versus amid rigid religious or social beliefs, and they're frequently more cordoned off, conformist, and chastising clusters, mean the ultimate degree of flexibility and the capacity to realign inner and outer worlds when needed varies drastically. Thus, myriad people possess a postmodern sensitivity to the anguish of human oppression and ecological destruction, are able to and willing to squarely face modernism's inequities and pathologies, and fully endorse the restructuring needed to address these. While, for whatever combination of internal and external reasons, it seems just as many, by and large, still attached to some blend of the same religious dogma, presumptions of cultural superiority, and or political or commercial interests that produce the doctrine of discovery, are fully dedicated to the equally disastrous doctrine of denial. There are numerous facets to this, but at its core is the adamant, don't mess with my consonants denial that modernism has any shadow side at all. Shipwreck? What shipwreck? And from the mid-20th century to until today, this has fueled a war of the world views between those striving to foster a more equitable and sustainable planetary community based on universal moral regard for others and the Earth, and those determined, consciously or unconsciously, to retain their inelastic psychological consonance and or their parochial power and privilege. Among the latter, from certain political factions to their strange bedfellow and acutely hypocritical religious bodies, to corporations, to mass and social media outlets, and on many other cultural fronts, unimaginable resources are aimed at maintaining this denial. And all these parties and efforts are just as profusely unimaginative, for they all amount to what scholar Henry Giroux calls disimagination machines. Because in that walled-off and hemmed-in worldview, imagining that society can be different is deemed dangerous. Hence, to sustain the crumbling order, it's imperative to shrivel our personal and collective imaginations and ideally suck them totally dry. One tactic is to present that world as self-evidently and unashamedly beyond reproach. This involves categorically dismissing any and all criticism, along with any proposals of new imaginative possibilities, as invalid, nigh unto insane. Reprising Wexler's phrasing, another is to chastise, devalue, and threaten with exclusion, or sometimes just threaten, anyone who espouses contrary positions, often with vehement and at times vicious scorn and ridicule. These feed into a third gambit, which is to sanctimoniously blame those who, in an equitable and sustainable planetary community, would now require equal consideration, to essentially say, if you don't fit my worldview, you're the problem. And there is a problem, except it's the doctrine of denial itself. For just as Campbell observed how the modern revolution delegitimized those great coordinating religious mythologies which now are known as lies, and thus rendered the ancient formula ineffective, misleading, and even pernicious, the postmodern transformation has done likewise with modernism. Because what renowned psychologist Carl Jung observed about individual life stories is also true of civilizational narratives and the historical eras based on them. Jung writes, "One cannot live in the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning. For what was great in the morning will be of little importance in the evening, and what in the morning was true will at evening become a lie. We'll continue next week by looking at more cultural effects of those disimaginative, denialist fabrications. Namaste and blessed be.